From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a daughter investigates the execution of her father. We talk with Aminata Forna. Her father, Dr. Mohamed Forna, was the Minister of Finance in Sierra Leone when it was a fledgling democracy. But after becoming an opponent of the increasingly authoritarian government, he was hanged in 1975. Also, writing the music for Chicago, we talk with John Kander, who with lyricist Fred Ebb also wrote the songs for Cabaret and the movie New York, New York. The movie adaptation of Chicago is nominated for 13 Oscars. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Turkey's parliament is expected to decide tomorrow whether to allow thousands of U.S. troops to deploy along the country's border with northern Iraq. If the bill passes, a U.S. mobilization in Turkey could begin as early as next week. NPR's Guy Raz reports from Ankara.
Under the deal negotiated between Washington and Ankara, 62,000 servicemen and women would enter Turkey over the next several weeks. Already, several U.S. ships are stationed off Turkey's southern coast, waiting to unload equipment. If Parliament passes the measure, troops will be deployed throughout southeastern Turkey. In the event of war, U.S. military planners are hoping to launch two fronts against Iraq, one from the south in Kuwait, the other from the north in Turkey. Turkey can expect up to $30 billion from Washington in loans and grants in return for cooperation. Guy Raz, NPR News, Ankara.
North Korea has reportedly restarted a controversial nuclear reactor. Pentagon officials said the North has activated a reactor that was shut down in 1994 under the terms of an agreement with the United States. The U.S. was concerned about that reactor because it's estimated to produce enough plutonium each year to build one nuclear bomb. The Reuters news agency quoted an unidentified official as saying that restarting the reactor was significant. He said it would be a greater provocation if the North were to restart a nuclear fuel processing facility, which would be the next step toward producing weapons-grade plutonium. Earlier this week, North Korea tested a short-range missile just before the inauguration of South Korea's new president. Israeli Foreign Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has rejected an offer to switch to finance minister in the new government being formed by Prime Minister Ariel Sharon. Netanyahu's rejection led to speculation that he might quit the government completely. NPR's Peter Kenyon reports.
Sharon is putting together a 68-seat ruling coalition in the 120-member Israeli parliament, and the finance cabinet seat has been a difficult one to fill. But no one predicted that Sharon would offer the post to his former rival Benjamin Netanyahu. Netanyahu joined Sharon's government as foreign minister after the Labor Party bolted last year. He made it clear that foreign minister was the only position he would accept in the new government. Analysts were surprised that Sharon would offer Netanyahu the finance chair, speculating that he no longer wanted the former prime minister in the government. Sharon then offered the foreign ministry to the current finance minister, Silvan Shalom, who accepted the prestigious post. The new government includes Sharon's Likud, the secular Shinui Party, and two right-wing parties. Peter Kenyon, NPR News, Jerusalem.
Stock prices closed lower today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 102 points, or 1.3%, to close at 7,806 in heavy trading. The NASDAQ Composite Index lost 25 points, or nearly 2%. It closed at 1,303. This is NPR News. The embattled chief executive of the U.S. Olympic Committee survived an attempt to fire him last night. Senior U.S. Olympic board members debated his future during a conference call. NPR's Howard Berkus reports.
The emergency conference call was supposed to be confidential, but details were leaked to several newspapers, and they report declining support for U.S. Olympic Committee CEO Lloyd Ward in the wake of almost daily allegations of wrongdoing. The latest charges involve more than $115,000 in travel expenses for Ward and his wife. Ward denies that any of the expenses are improper. But the daily barrage of news stories about Ward and growing unrest among corporate Olympic sponsors has U.S. Olympic board members considering his departure. That was reportedly proposed in the conference call, but no vote was taken because the call was not considered an official meeting. Congressional scrutiny of the leadership and ethics crisis continues Friday when U.S. senators hear from Olympic athletes and employees at U.S. Olympic headquarters in Colorado Springs. Howard Berkus, NPR News.
The Bush administration has rejected a proposal by Canada to give Iraq until the end of March to comply with UN demands to disarm. The proposal was offered as a compromise between the U.S.-led faction in the UN, which wants immediate authorization to take military action, and the French-led side, which wants inspections to take as long as they need to. State Department spokesman Richard Boucher said the plan only puts off a decision that all the parties should be prepared to make. Canada's plan would have given Iraq until the end of March to complete a list of requirements prepared by the weapons inspectors. The Security Council would then be called upon to vote on whether Iraq was complying. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Sodexo, providing innovative approaches to food and facilities management services throughout North America, on the web at SodexoUSA.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is the daughter of an African leader who was executed in 1975. In her new memoir, Aminata Forna investigates what happened to her father and what it reveals about the country she is from, Sierra Leone. The book is called The Devil That Danced on the Water. Her father, Dr. Mohamed Forna, studied medicine in Scotland, where he met his first wife, a white Scottish woman. With his wife, he returned to Sierra Leone, where Aminata was born. Dr. Forna practiced medicine and then became one of the new generation of political leaders in the 60s when Sierra Leone was a fledgling democracy breaking away from British colonial rule. After becoming Minister of Finance, he became an opponent of the increasingly authoritarian government, was removed from office, and later accused of conspiracy. In 1975, he was hanged with seven others. After one of his imprisonments, Aminata, her siblings, and her stepmother, her father had remarried, fled the country. She has since lived in England. She has vivid memories of her father's 1974 arrest when she was 10.
The night my father was arrested, I always have remembered quite clearly. We were at home, and I was alone in the sitting room. I was laying out a game that we were going to play that evening. My father was in the bedroom with my mother. The house had been quite quiet that day, although I came to remember that part later. I looked up from what I was doing, laying out some bingo cards, and I saw two men standing on our balcony. I went out and asked them what they wanted, and they told me they were here to speak to the doctor. And I went to the bedroom door to fetch my father. He came out directly and spoke to the men, and then he turned to me and said that he had to go with these men now and asked me to fetch him a couple of toothpicks from the sideboard. He used to have a habit of chewing toothpicks. And I did that. And then the very last thing he said was, tell Mum I'll be back later. So that actually was the last but one time I saw him. The next time I saw him, he was in handcuffs and he'd already been condemned to death. But I was the last person to see him go.
What was he arrested for?
He was arrested and later charged with treason, and his arrest followed an attack on, or an alleged attack, on the house of the vice president. Somebody had thrown dynamite at it, and my father was accused of being part of a plot to overthrow the government.
You were 11 at the time your father was hanged. You were living in Sierra Leone, but you were being educated in England, so you were spending a lot of time away from home, and you were in England on the day he was executed. Did you understand what was happening? What were you told?
I wasn't told very much. I mean, in that era, in the 70s, and also particularly in that culture, it was not really felt that you told children very much. I think people felt that they were protecting children, protecting us in this particular instance by not telling us anything. So I didn't, had only a vague idea. What it did to me, not being told, was that it created this enormous curiosity. And my brother and sister and I used to snoop and rifle and try to get as much information as we could. I knew that he was in prison. I knew that he was being charged for treason. I didn't have any understanding at that age that treason was a capital offence. And when he died, I was told, in fact, that he died of an illness. He died in prison of an illness.
Let's back up a little bit. Your father was a doctor. He was trained in Scotland. He went to medical school in Aberdeen. He had returned to Sierra Leone after school, set up a clinic there. How and why did he get involved with politics?
My father was always political, with a small p. He was always very active. He always had a very strong sense of the injustices that he saw around him. And even when he was at school, he was already writing letters about constitutional changes and posting them off to newspapers and to the government. He became a doctor because he thought that he might rectify that, but also because those were the sorts of scholarships that were being offered. But it fitted with his vision. He went back to Sierra Leone at a time when the incumbent government were moving the country towards a one-party state, and this was happening all over Africa. And the opposition, the APC, were looking for young men, particularly Western-educated young men, because they needed these people to gain some kind of credibility among certain populations in the country, the middle-class population, the city-based population, and also Western governments and agencies. My father resisted in the first instance, but gradually, as he, I think, became overwhelmed by the level of poverty and mismanagement in the country, he gradually allowed himself to be wooed into the party, and he agreed to stand as an MP.
So he was trying to keep a two-party system and to stop a kind of one-party dictatorship.
Yeah, I mean, the APC was fighting the election. His party was fighting the election on that very ticket, that they would stop a one-party state coming into Sierra Leone, as it had in Ghana, in Kenya, you know, in so many other countries in Africa.
When did you decide that you wanted to find out the real story behind your father's trial and execution?
Well, I can't even remember that, because it was a lifetime ago. Well, I always knew I didn't know enough about it. My stepmother had always tried to protect me by not telling me very much. In fact, later on, when I did decide to write the book and when I talked to her about it, she said that actually one of the reasons she'd been like that was because she was on the verge of falling apart herself, and the only way that she could protect us and herself was by really trying to move on and not revisit it. But it seemed to us, that this, us the children, this incredible silence surrounded everything about my father. And yet there was this anomaly. He had been hanged as a traitor. I knew that by then. And yet when I visited Sierra Leone, when I walked down the street among the ordinary people, he was treated as a hero. People came up and embraced me. People would give me a few mangoes or bananas and not ask me to pay for them. Taxi drivers would let me off my taxi fare. So those were the two things that were not reconciled. Why was he hanged as a traitor and yet treated, his memory treated in that way? So gradually I wanted more and more of these questions resolved. And the other major thing was that I knew gradually, by a process, I suppose, of osmosis, eavesdropping and reading documents I shouldn't have, I knew that on the fateful night where he was supposed to be attacking or leading an attack on the vice president's house, I knew, because I remembered it vividly, that he had been at home because something very important had happened that night.
What happened?
A man was brought to our house with a wounded hand. And my father had dressed his hand, and I had helped my father to bandage the man's hand. And that turned out to be something that was absolutely pivotal in his trial.
Was that brought up in the trial? Did the man who was wounded testify on behalf of your father?
The man that was wounded, I discovered later, when I came to research my father's trial, had died before the trial. Curiously, he didn't play a very important part in the trial, although he was definitely linked with whatever events had occurred at the vice president's house. He was an armed military man, a soldier. He was involved in something, and he'd been hurt handling, apparently, a grenade.
So was the prosecutor just trying to overlook as much as possible the fact that your father had treated this man, because that would be an alibi and the prosecutor didn't want him to have one?
That's correct. The fact my father had treated the man proved that he was somewhere else on the night that this attack had happened. And what they were trying to do was prove that my father had been part of the attack. Later on, I traced the four witnesses who had given evidence against my father and placed him at the site of the alleged attack, or of the attack, whoever carried it out. And all four of those men admitted that they had been paid to say that they'd seen him there.
How much did they get in return for handing over your father?
In fact, they'd been promised money, and the first one that I interviewed spent some time complaining to me that he'd never received the money that he had been promised. They were promised jobs, they were promised scholarships to universities in the West, and they were promised cash, and they didn't see very much of that, and two of them still felt extremely aggrieved that they had never received the money that they had been promised. They didn't seem to feel in any way, they didn't seem to feel any remorse at all for what they'd done. They didn't even seem to appreciate they were sitting opposite the person that they had helped to kill's daughter. They just, even 25 years later, cared only about the money.
So did you get angry with them sitting across from them getting these stories, or did you just be neutral so you could get more information?
Yeah, I did the latter. I mean, one of the reasons it took me a while to write the book, I mean, although, you know, I was in my mid-30s when I wrote it, it didn't take me a huge amount of time to get on with it. But I do remember, I mean, I wanted to write this for a very long time. And in my mid-20s, I felt to myself, I'm not mature enough to do this. I don't have the emotional maturity. And I also really knew that I needed to be a much, much better journalist to approach a story that involved me so closely and that was such a complicated story. So by the time that I was sitting opposite the men who had given evidence, false testimony against my father, I had accomplished a fair amount of self-control and I didn't display it. And I could see, you know, in Sierra Leone, I'm mixed race. People considered me to be white, or they see me as European. So I could see that the reality of who I was wasn't really set, you know, sitting with this man. And also, I never, ever used to refer to my father as my father when I interviewed people. I always referred to him as Dr. Fauna. And that was part of trying to distance me from the subject matter. And it did appear to work. Neither of these two men really, really seemed to be registering the fact that they were talking to the person's daughter. And I felt that if I... you know, if I interrupted our interview and laboured that fact or alerted them to it or reminded them of it, that they wouldn't tell me so much.
My guest is Aminata Forna. Her new memoir is called The Devil That Danced on the Water. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Aminata Forna, and she's written a new memoir about investigating the execution of her father. And her father had been the Minister of Finance in Sierra Leone. He was executed by the dictatorship in 1975. You not only investigated how your father was set up at his trial, you also investigated what he had to say. How did he carry himself at his trial? What did you learn about that?
I was immensely proud when I discovered how my father had conducted himself at his trial. There was a moment when the prosecutor, whose name was Tom Johnson, confronted my father with the testimony of another man who had... one of the other accused who had placed my father at the scene of the attack. And what was already quite well known, and my father would certainly have guessed, was that the other people who'd been arrested alongside him had been very badly beaten, many of them tortured, and this false testimony drawn from them. This was read out in court and used against my father. And the chief prosecutor asked my father, is it true? And my father said, no, it is not true. And the chief prosecutor said, have you no conscience to say that this man who is your friend is a liar? And my father replied to him, I have a conscience and I have a heart. And what he meant by that was, what I understood he meant by that was, that he knew that these people were giving testimony because they had been beaten, because they had been tortured, and because they had been forced to. And I think that's what he meant when he said, I have a heart.
In other words, that he was forgiving them for testifying against him.
Exactly, that he was forgiving them. He knew how the system worked there, and I think that some of the beatings took place fairly publicly. In fact, in one of the very last letters he wrote, he described hearing some of the men being beaten, and he described overhearing a conversation between two of them where one had said, if you give them Dr. Mohammed Sfona's name, they'll stop beating you.
Do you think if he had made a deal that he could have survived?
I think it's possible. I think that is possible. Shaka Stevens knew that my father was immensely popular. He knew that he was the only person who could lead a viable opposition against him. Shaka Stevens also had come to hate my father because when my father resigned, he had alerted the country and the entire international community to Shaka Stevens's corruption. He'd accused him of violence, he'd accused him of megalomania, and apparently Stevens was absolutely enraged by this. But I think it's faintly possible that Stevens might have spared him if he had had the kind of response from my father that would have made that possible. I'm not certain about it, but he might just have.
Your father had been a medical doctor. When you returned to Sierra Leone to investigate his execution, you were probably seeing lots of people who had hands or feet amputated. During the Civil War, the rebels had threatened people with amputations if they voted, because the rebels didn't want them to vote. And I'm just wondering your impressions of traveling through your country of birth and seeing people who had lost limbs in the Civil War through amputations.
It's a very shocking thing, the loss of limbs. And although it is ascribed, the action on the part of the rebels of chopping off people's hands is ascribed to being a comment on the elections, what I saw did not seem to tally with that explanation. I saw babies who had lost both arms. I remember seeing a very pretty young girl. In fact, I took her photograph, and she really wanted to be photographed with her friend. And to a Western eye, it was a really shocking picture because there she was with both arms chopped off above the elbow and her friend who'd lost one arm. There was no explanation for that, really. There was simply no explanation for it. And I have, when I was last back, which was actually only 3 or 4 weeks ago, I was in a position to talk to people who had been in the area where these sorts of things were happening. And there seems to be a huge amount of denial about it now. The rebels, the RUF, deny that it was anything to do with them. They say that it was the Kamajors who were one of the militias who fought against them. They say it wasn't them, that it was the government forces. So now there's a huge amount of denial, and I can't imagine that it was anything but a drug. I mean, there's a huge amount of drug use, deliberate use on child soldiers, a kind of drug-fueled aggression towards a civilian population to do anything to subdue them.
This kind of massive, sadistic terrorist campaign.
I think so, yes.
What are your feelings about your country now? You know, the country of your birth. You loved it when you grew up there. The government had executed your father. You returned, you know, recently to find the aftermath of this campaign of terrorism.
I'm cautiously optimistic about Sierra Leone. I mean, it has taken me a long time to feel comfortable again there. I dreaded going back when I was researching the book. I always felt deeply unhappy when I was in the country in a way that, you know, I could only ascribe to the events that had taken place there. And I remember when I was a child, I used to look forward so much to going home to Sierra Leone. And from the moment of my father's death, I could no longer bear to go to that country until I came to the point where I avoided it altogether for 10 or 15 years. Gradually, I've got more used to going back there, and I've begun to enjoy it again. And this time I went up to my father's village. In fact, the village that my grandfather had founded, which is deep in the... It's actually surrounded by forest, and it is the most beautiful place. And I spent a week there with my husband. We were building a school for the village. And I was just surrounded by people of such kindness and goodwill. So, you know, a kind of lot of my childhood sense has returned.
In your acknowledgements, you mentioned a couple of people who have been in slightly similar situations to you. You mentioned Jillian Slovo, whose parents were with the African, with the ANC, the African National Congress, and I believe one of her parents was executed.
Her mother was murdered.
Yeah, and her parents were anti-apartheid activists. And you mentioned Ken Wiwa, whose father was a dissident in Nigeria, and he was executed. I find it really interesting that in your case and in Ken Wiwa's case, by writing about your parents' execution, you're making it less possible for people to forget this happened. In spite of the government's attempt to, like, annihilate the bodies and, you know, put them in mass graves and just kind of write them out of history and cover it up to whatever extent they could.
It was my intention, really, to bring stories like this to the public consciousness in the West. My father wasn't really anybody who had a significance outside of Sierra Leone. He was one of thousands of political prisoners imprisoned and killed across Africa. And so I used his story in a way that I felt was emblematic, that he was emblematic, we were emblematic of what had happened to Africa in the post-colonial period. And I really felt that in my position, being partly British and partly African, and having so many friends, you know, I would sit at middle-class dinner parties in London, and I would hear people talk about Africa as though it were another world, not just another continent. It's the difficulty people have in understanding what's going on in Africa, the sort of, not boredom, but you know, the tiredness of the constant problems, and also the exoticization, the alienation of Africans who we see so much on our news programs just as heaped dead bodies somewhere, but not as individuals. And I thought, I would think, if you knew my story and you knew what had happened to somebody sitting at this table, somebody you could associate with, if you could make that connection, then you would feel quite differently about Africa. And so that was, I very deliberately attempted to do that.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
That's very kind of you. Thank you very much.
Aminata Forna's new memoir is called The Devil That Danced on the Water. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Your funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by the National Endowment for the Arts, this is NPR, National Public Radio.
The movie musical Chicago is nominated for 13 Oscars. Coming up, we talk with John Kander about writing the songs with his partner Fred Ebb. They also wrote the songs for Cabaret and the movie New York, New York.
5, 6, 7, 8.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The movie adaptation of the Broadway musical Chicago is nominated for 13 Oscars. My guest John Kander wrote the music for Chicago, along with his longtime songwriting partner, lyricist Fred Ebb. They also wrote the songs for Cabaret, Kiss of the Spider Woman, Woman of the Year, and the Martin Scorsese movie New York, New York, which included their song New York, New York. The original Broadway production of Chicago premiered in 1975. It was choreographed and directed by Bob Fosse and starred his wife Gwen Verdon and Cheetah Rivera. The show was based on a play inspired by a sensational 1924 murder trial in the city of Chicago. The musical tells the story of two singers who each murdered the man who betrayed her and the lawyer who manipulates the media and turns the murderers into celebrities. The adaptation was written by Bob Fosse and lyricist Fred Ebb. Here's the opening song from the movie soundtrack featuring Catherine Zeta-Jones.
Come on, babe, why don't we paint the town? And all that jazz, I'm gonna rouge my knees and roll my stockings down. And all that jazz, start the car, I know a whoopee spot. Well, the gin is cold, but the piano's hot. It's just a noisy hall where there's a nightly brawl. And all that jazz.
John Kander, welcome to Fresh Air. It's great you're up for all these Academy Award nominations, 13. In 1975, when the show was on Broadway, you got 11 Tony nominations, and I think you didn't win any of them, right?
No, we were up against Chorus Line at that time. Also, Chicago in 1975 got very mixed reviews. And I must say, speaking with out of my vanity, it's terrific that after all these years, some of the same critics who didn't like it in 1975 seem to like it and approve of it, and that I get a real kick out of that.
Is this a show you always loved? I mean, where do you see this fitting into your body of work?
Well, this is a show which I grew to love. This is my partner Fred Ebb's favorite show, I'm sure. He was very excited about it from the very start. It took me a little longer to sort of warm up to doing it.
But yet, why did you have to warm up to it?
Because I remember when the idea was first brought to us, and Fred was extremely enthusiastic, and God knows I was excited to work with Bob Fosse and Gwen Verdon. I was worried that we were writing yet another piece about show business as a metaphor for life. But as we got into it, I liked it more and more, and now I'm really crazy about it.
Bob Fosse and Gwen Verdon were getting a divorce when Chicago was in the works. And I've read that this was kind of Fosse's, it was part of Fosse's divorce settlement with Gwen Verdon to give her a part in this musical. What a strange sounding story that is for a husband and wife to be collaborating on a musical as they're divorcing.
Well, even after the divorce, they maintained a very strong relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And after Bobby's death, Gwen continued to be his chronicler, if you will, and the defender of his work. So I guess the marriage didn't work, but the collaboration certainly did.
I should mention that Gwen Verdon played the part of Roxy Hart, the part that's played by Renee Zellweger in the movie version. Bob Fosse had a heart attack after the rehearsal started for Chicago. That must have been devastating for everybody.
It was about 3 days into rehearsal, and yes, he had I don't know whether it was a triple bypass or quadruple bypass, but it was very serious. And when we resumed rehearsals some months later, his personality was pretty dark by then. I think he'd been through a great deal, and I think Fred would agree with me that affected in some way the work that we did on the show. The show itself became more biting, more cynical, if you will, than it had even started out to be. And there was always a kind of not a death wish, but there was always a something self-destructive about Bobby's behavior. He was a terrific man with a very dark side.
I'd like to play a recording that you and your songwriting partner, Fred Ebb, the lyricist, made together in 1973 while you were performing at the 92nd Street Y in New York's Lyrics and Lyricists series. This is a series in which
they
had songwriters come in and do their work. So this was 1973, before Chicago had actually opened on Broadway, so nobody knew these songs. You were still working everything out. And I'm going to play your version of All That Jazz. And Kander's at the piano. Fred Ebb is singing, but then John Kander comes in and makes it a duet.
Find a flask, we're playing fast and loose. And all that jazz right up here is where I store the juice. And all that jazz, come on, babe, we're gonna brush the sky. I bet your lucky Lindy never flew so high. Cause in the stratosphere, how could he lend an ear to all of that? A jazz. Oh, you're gonna see a sheep, a shimmy shake, and all that jazz. Oh, gonna shimmy till my garters break, and all that jazz. Show me where to park my girdle. Oh, my mother's bought a curdle. If she'd hear her baby's queer for all that jazz. Stockings down and all that jazz. Start the garden of a whoopee spot where the gin is cold but the piano's hot. It's just a noisy hall where there's a nightly crawl and all that jazz.
That's John Kander and Fred Ebb performing their song All That Jazz from the musical Chicago. This was recorded in 1973 at the 92nd Street Y in New York. Now, the song kind of turns into a canon or a round in the duet part.
It's just a little counterpoint. The chorus is singing one thing, and Velma Kelly, who was singing All That Jazz, is singing another thing. And we've done that a lot in our careers. Any composing team does. So just a contrapuntal section to make the song work toward a climax.
How tricky is that to write?
It's tricky only in, like working out a puzzle is tricky. It's fun. And as a matter of fact, I think the secret of our longevity is that writing for us has always been fun and still is to this day. Otherwise, we wouldn't do it. We write, we enjoy the process of writing. There was a time out of town with Chicago where Fosse almost apologetically asked us to write a song to replace a song near the end of the show. And it was as if he was saying, oh, I'm sorry to ask you to do this terrible thing. And well, we looked at our shoes and allowed us how we'd give it a shot. And then we left the rehearsal room and went skipping down the hotel room, the hotel corridor practically, because we were so delighted to get back to what we like to do. So we wrote a song in a half an hour called Nowadays and took the rest of the day off.
Let's hear the torchy version that's sung by Roxy Hart. And we'll hear from the movie soundtrack, Renee Zellweger.
It's good, isn't it? Isn't it great? Isn't it swell? Isn't it fun? Isn't it nowadays? There's men everywhere, jazz everywhere, booze everywhere, life everywhere, joy.
That's Renee Zellweger singing Nowadays from the soundtrack of the film Chicago. We'll talk more with composer John Kander after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is John Kander. He wrote the music for Chicago. I know you didn't write the lyrics. Your partner, Fred Ebb, did. But you must have both really steeped yourself in the language and music and stories of the 1920s to do Chicago, which is the decade that the musical set in. What are some of the things that you immersed yourself in to write Chicago?
Well, I know Fred did a great deal of research. As a matter of fact, I think the phrase "all that jazz" came out of an article that he read. And as far as the music is concerned, I listened to a lot of jazz of the 20s, a lot of old recordings, and then just forgot about them. Hoping that the style would seep through somehow. Plus the fact that Chicago is a vaudeville. We call it a vaudeville for a number of reasons. But one of the reasons that we call it that is because many of the songs are related to specific vaudeville performers, Eddie Cantor, Helen Morgan, Sophie Tucker, Burt Williams. And so we listen to recordings by those people as well.
If your partner Fred Ebb was here, I would ask him a question that maybe you know the answer to. What does it mean in the lyric of "All That Jazz" to rouge your knees? Did people rouge their knees?
Yep, they sure did.
And what was that about? They actually put red stuff on their knees.
Their skirts were higher, and you would rouge your knees and wear your stockings down. And then go out in Charleston.
I guess that was very sexy.
I guess so.
I mean, in that period, it was considered very sexy.
Sure.
Now, you were writing songs that you knew Bob Fosse would be using as the music for his choreography. You were already very well acquainted with Bob Fosse's choreography because you'd collaborated together on Cabaret. Were there certain rhythms that you knew would work for Fosse choreography that you intentionally put in, not only because it was set in the 20s, but because of Fosse?
I think so. Fred was very smart about that. I remember we wrote a song called Razzle Dazzle. And before we took it and played it for Bob, Fred said, try adding a couple of finger snaps to it. Bobby will love that. And what turned out was da-dum, da-dum, da-da-dum. And those claps were finger snaps just then. And he said it with absolute assurance, and we took it in and played it for Bob, and as soon as he heard the fingers snapping, he loved the song.
There's a similar rhythm going on in All That Jazz. There's two beats that could easily be a couple of hip bumps and grinds.
Yes, I think that's true. I think probably if you listen to the score of Chicago straight through, you would find a certain amount of continuity or similarity particularly with the accompanimental figures in a lot of the songs. That's mostly unconscious, as I said, just listening to a lot of jazz of that period and then letting your brain soak in it and then just writing.
What's your collaborating process with lyricist Fred Ebb?
It started when we first began to write together, and it's still the same today. I go over to Fred's house, and we talk for a long time, and if we're working on a show, we speak about the moment that we're about to try and musicalize, and we talk and talk and talk, and then maybe Fred will have a lyrical phrase, like All That Jazz. And maybe I'll have a rhythmic idea. And from then on, we improvise together. and literally together. And it's Fred never hands me a lyric and says, set this. I never hand him a completed melodic chart and say, write a lyric to this. We just don't work that way. The numbers of, I would say 95% of everything we've written together, we've written in the same room at the same time. But ever since we started writing together, we've been faithful.
How do you know in the book for a show, when is the right time for a song? Is it just like the pacing, or is there a certain kind of emotion that calls for a song?
Well, the simplest answer, it seems to me, is when a character has reached that point where dialogue seems insufficient. We've worked with some terrific collaborators who understand that. Terrence McNally, with whom we've done three shows, is very good at writing a scene that has five pages in it that he knows perfectly well we're going to steal and musicalize, but where he will let a character go on in dialogue in a way which is probably unnatural for him emotionally to do. And that he does that in order to turn Fred and me on to musicalizing it. In Chicago, because it was a vaudeville, it was a little more cut and dried. We would get to a point where Mama Morton, for instance, appears on the scene, and she needs to tell the audience exactly who she is. And that seems more natural in song than in dialogue.
Do you think you would have written as many songs if it weren't for the fact that there's the show that you're obliged to write, and you have to come up with 10 songs for the show, the pressure's on?
I probably would not have. There's something about the responsibility that you have in a collaboration which is a spur to me. I've always written music, and I probably always would, but when you have a structure and you have collaborators and you have a room full of actors who are waiting to be fed, it makes you get to work.
My guest is John Kander. He composed the songs for the musical Chicago. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is John Kander. He composed the songs for the musical Chicago with his partner, lyricist Fred Ebb. They also wrote the songs for Cabaret and the Martin Scorsese movie New York, New York. Let me ask you about one of your most famous musicals, which is Cabaret. At what point did you enter the process?
Well, we had done a musical called Flora the Red Menace, which Hal Prince produced and George Abbott directed. And Liza Minnelli starred in it, and it was her kind of her Broadway debut. A couple of weeks before the opening in New York, Hal Prince said something which I've told this story often. I can't imagine a producer in his right mind today saying. He said, "No matter what happens with Flora, the day after it opens, we'll meet at my house to start talking about the next musical." Well, Flora opened, and it was not a success. And the next day, we were at Hal's house talking about a musical which came to be called Cabaret.
What was the discussion like that day?
Well, he had the rights to the Berlin stories. And
the Christopher Isherwood stories.
Yes, Christopher Isherwood stories and the John Van Druten play, which had been based on them. And he had a writer named Joe Masteroff, with whom he'd had some discussions. And from that very first day, we started our conversations, which eventually lead to knocking out a narrative. It's what I was talking about before. The whole collaborative experience that we have had has been very fortunate in that what if Sally Bowles has an abortion? What if somebody throws a brick through the window? It's a game that I've come to call What If. It's really a lot of fun. Everything is possible. And the director, the writer, the composers sit in this room and imagine elements in a story. Imagine characters. It's terrific. It's and it's a real turn on for me.
For Chicago, you listen to a lot of music from the 20s. What did you listen to for Cabaret?
For Cabaret, I listened to a lot of German jazz and vaudeville music, of the late 20s and very early 30s, and then promptly forgot about it. It's the same thing happened with Zorba and listening to a lot of Greek music and to Kiss of the Spider Woman with Latin American music. It sounds like a very kind of crude way of doing research, but it works for me. You listen and you listen and you listen and then put it away and don't think about it anymore. And I have this absolute belief that the styles that you have been listening to, of the music that you've been listening to, seep into your unconscious and come out in your own language.
Your work keeps getting new lives. You know, Chicago had a big revival in 96. It's still running on Broadway, and of course now it's a hugely successful movie. Cabaret, there was a revival, a very successful revival of that just a few years ago on Broadway.
And that's still running as well.
Do you think that the musicals keep changing as they're given new lives? I mean, for example, correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems to me that Chicago keeps getting slightly more S&M in tone as time goes on, and probably Cabaret also, at least on the part of the MC, the character that was originated by Joel Grey.
I think any piece of musical theater, whether it's an opera or a musical comedy or whatever, if it's a piece which has some value, whenever it's revived, it will be revived within the recognizable language of its contemporary audience. Is that a sentence that I just made there?
Good enough for me.
So that when Cabaret was first done in 1966, it was in many ways quite shocking to its audience, to that audience in 1966, and considered almost avant-garde. When the revival that Sam Mendes and Rob Marshall did came along, the one that's running today, it also became somewhat shocking to its contemporary audience. So in a funny way, Cabaret now feels to its contemporary audience the way it felt to its audience in 1966, even though the two productions are quite different.
Mm-hmm. I understand what you're saying. Do you ever wish that life was a little bit more like a musical and that there would be certain occasions where you could break into song and dance?
Well, yes. Unfortunately, I don't wish that life were like our musicals, considering how many people we've killed.
Too many murders.
Yeah. I mean, Fred and I have been involved in some pretty heavy stuff in musical theater. As a matter of fact, the other day we were trying to count up how many people we've killed in our musicals.
But the songs are good.
Thank you.
I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
I assume you're going to the Academy Awards.
I don't know. That's pretty scary. We'll see.
You're actually thinking of not going.
It's conceivable. We don't know yet. A lot of it.
Why would you not go?
Because it's terrifying.
Wait, you wouldn't be terrified sitting at home? I mean, you'll still be in suspense.
I could sit in front of a television set and drink heavily and not. I don't know yet. Half of me wants to and half of me doesn't. We'll see.
Okay. Well, good luck.
Thank you so much.
Okay. Good to talk with you. Thank you.
Same here.
John Kander wrote the music for Chicago. The movie adaptation is nominated for 13 Academy Awards.
Mr. Billy Flynn in the press conference rag. Notice how his mouth never moves. Almost.
Where'd you come from?
Mississippi.
And your parents?
Very wealthy.
Where are they now?
6 feet under. But she was granted one more start, the convent of the Sacred Heart.
Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, and Jessica Chu. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
I met Amos and he stole my heart away, convinced me to elope one day.
Oh, you poor dear, I can't believe what you've been through. A convent girl, a runaway marriage. Now tell us, Roxy, who's Fred Casely?
My ex-boyfriend.
Why'd you shoot him?
I was leaving.
Was he angry?
Like a madman. Still, I said, Fred, move along. She knew that she was doing wrong.
Then describe it.
He came toward me.
With a pistol.
From my bureau.
Did you fight him?
Like a tiger. He had strength and she had none. And yet we both reached for the gun. I'm yet so young. Yes, we both, oh yes, we both, oh yes, we both reach for the gun, the gun, the gun, the gun. Oh yes, we both reach for the gun, for the gun. Understandable, understandable. Yes, it's perfectly understandable, comprehensible.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Delta Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of Blue Poppies, a novel set in 1950s Tibet by Jonathan Falla. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, does the media have a liberal bias, or a conservative bias, or a pro-business bias? I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.